Welcome to the Mindfulness Podcast. This is Dr. David Black. My guest today is Dr. Rebecca Crane, professor of psychology at Bangor University in the United Kingdom. There she directs the Center for Mindfulness Research and Practice. She is a certified MBSR teacher, as well as a lead teacher trainer, so teacher of teachers for MBSR and mindfulness-based cognitive therapy and probably other programs that we'll talk about. Her research focuses on clarifying best standards for teaching, best adaptations for teaching of mindfulness programs. She authored the book, Mindfulness-Based Cognitive Therapy, Distinctive Features in 2017, and recently co-edited Essential Resources for Mindfulness Teachers in 2021. Welcome, Dr. Crane. I have a personal love for teaching, so this is going to be a fun topic for me today. I've been teaching for 17 years at the university level, undergraduate, master's level, PhD level, and there's just something inside me that burns to teach. It's not something I think you can really control, and I'm sure there are a lot of people out there like this. They want others to be their best selves, and in doing so, we're always on ourselves to get it right, to get the best curriculum, to deliver it the way that really can have an impact. Maybe we're misguided in a way sometimes. Maybe we're not doing it right. And that's kind of your job. So tell me about this work you've been focused on, like how to make a program right. What does that mean?
Thank you, David. It's a real pleasure to be with you. And likewise, I think I feel at my most alive when I'm in the teaching space. And just really feel endlessly passionate about the process and about investigating the process and discovering how we might make it more optimal. So it's just a real pleasure to engage in this conversation with you. And so we've had a Center for Mindfulness at Bangor University since the early 2000s, which we came about because Mark Williams was developing MBCT and researching MBCT here. And the question that was coming towards him at that time a lot was, how do we train? There's something here that we want to bring into our context. So, you know, how do I become an MB whatever teacher? And at that time in the UK, there was no training available. And so he wanted to begin to develop ways of training. And I'd been involved in the process of the trial delivery. I was working locally, clinically, and had a long mindfulness practice. And so he invited me to join the team at the university to help solve those challenges of how do we begin to focus on this question of training others to offer this. So that was the beginning.
Yeah, and what an important beginning, because that's what we'd like to do. We create a program. Mm. In a way, it becomes our baby, like when we create a curriculum. Yeah. And we're like, oh, if we could just get it right, and if we feel like we have the ingredients right, if we just hand it off to others, we're like, oh, did you get the ingredients right that we were talking about? Absolutely. And at times you may see someone delivering, you're like, oh, that's actually not what I was intending to do with this program. And from a teacher's perspective, you know, you want things to be just right. So in your work, you talk about things like fidelity, integrity. What do these terms mean for the general public when we're trying to get things just right?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's a really interesting question, what fidelity means in the context of mindfulness interventions, because generally speaking, fidelity means getting the contents right. So making sure that all the ingredients are present in an intervention or a program of whatever. And of course, that's true in the mindfulness context, but it also fidelity in a mindfulness context also means fidelity to the spirit, and part of the spirit of mindfulness, of offering mindfulness based interventions, is this spirit of responsiveness to the process and to the emergence of the moment and to what's happening for participants and what's happening in the space. And so that's part of fidelity, is this actually being willing to go off piste if it's in the service of the main thing, which is developing the capacities to be aware and present, to experience and to respond from that place. So it's, you know, this is in a way where mindfulness interventions are not about just delivering a curriculum. The curriculum is a vehicle. And it's, so the fidelity is not just adhering to a curriculum, it's adhering to a way, a process of engaging.
So it, there's art in it, it seems.
There's,
so
for sure.
If I'm in a class and really wanting to get a single objective through for that, say, 60-minute class, and a question comes up that touches on the idea, it's not exactly where we were headed, but I'm just wanting to make sure I get this example right. You may explore what that is and try to reconnect it to the larger objective. And in doing so, you stay with the education writ large, because if you like resist, stop this person's perspective, think that your subjective experience is better than the students, you can create, maybe lose the higher order objective. So it seems like you're talking about an art, that there's a structure, which you definitely, and we'll get to this, you've tried to create to help people see this. But then there's the art of going with whatever is happening in the classroom. I think there's long-term understanding through educators, like you have to go with that something that's happening in the classroom.
Where's the aliveness, you know? And I love, you know, the Stephen Covey's often quoted saying, the main thing is to keep the main thing, the main thing. So it's like that real clarity. What is the main thing here? And the main thing isn't the curriculum. The main thing is the learning of this way of being with experience. And so you're following that thread. Yeah, absolutely.
I love that saying, because it's making me think of the classroom dynamic again. And that aliveness when you're excited. So let's say you're teaching some content. And I don't know if excitement is part of, or maybe it is part of the mindfulness-based programming. But in the classroom, when you have young minds and you see that there's an opportunity and you're just naturally excited, and it's not exactly where you were headed, but it's the excitement. And that's probably part of the educational opportunity. It's like, oh, the aliveness of whatever that is, whatever this person is shining their eyes about and, you know, showing like this love for, that's something that's of relevance, it's of interest. And maybe the students don't fully grasp it yet. It's even a chemistry concept, but there's something about this that makes this person come alive.
For
and
sure.
I might get there, right? So
absolutely.
That kind of energy.
Exactly
in the room.
That. Yeah. You know, so in children, you're wanting to really cultivate this love of learning. So that's what you're, that's the passion you're following. Absolutely. So, but then that really steers how you engage in the process of training teachers, because if that's the main thing, then the main thing that you really want to cultivate in trainee teachers is the capacity to be responsive, to have the resources within themselves to be able to tune to, you know, what's most important here, what's most alive, where's the energy, where's the vitality, you know, where's, you know, how does this, what's emerging, this story that's emerging from this particular participant, how could this be in the service of this bigger thing that we're all exploring here? And that's a particular resource that takes time to cultivate. And of course, cultivating your own mindfulness practice is a big part of that, but it's not the only thing. You know, there's other skills that sort of get folded around that. But that whole, you know, that's the piece that shapes the way we train teachers.
Yeah, that's very good. And this idea that the teacher has to have their own depth of practice, I think, is also associated with depth of knowledge that people who teach over the years can accumulate. And because when they see the opportunity for these things to arise, like whether it be the joy of learning, the content itself, the teacher, from my perspective, sees all the levels that are underlying this question that the individual hasn't yet seen. And so it's making me think when you said that, like the personal practice, so you can see those levels and like, oh, the person is here now. This is where they are. This is where their mind is. How far can I dig with this? You know, because you can see those various levels from working with people through the years, like, oh, they usually would transition to this new level of knowing, awareness, and how do we get there? Mm-hmm. And so could you talk about, is that relevant? I'm just, you know, I'm thinking about knowledge in the classroom and trying to get a curriculum. And where you're talking about mindfulness-based practice. How does the teacher through practice come to know something similar to that illustration?
Absolutely. And there's so many dimensions to the piece that you've just explored. You know, that there's a huge relational dimension of knowing, really discerning in the moment of connection with one particular participant. How far do I go with this in this moment? So you may be seeing depths that actually don't feel appropriate to engage in, either because it's not the right stage in the learning process or because of the vulnerability that that person is showing in that moment. So there's that whole discernment. And then there's the other piece that you're pointing to around that, you know, that mindfulness practice is, of course, a very experiential engagement. And surrounding that is a whole body of understanding of what it means to be human and what it is to suffer and how the processes that are inherent within the human process actually drive that suffering. And what are the places where we can intervene with that? And so there's a whole conceptualization, a whole body of teachings that surround the practice that are embedded, you know, as we develop the practice and engage with the teachings. And of course, you know, a teacher of MBSR or MBCT is drawing from contemporary understandings as well as the traditional teachings within the Buddhist context. So there's a whole there's this whole body of wisdom that as you know is the teacher is aware of, and as a participant is coming with their process, there's a sense of helping them to explore, but exploring from a context of recognition of these processes. So in some senses it's an open exploration, because you're not wanting to prejudge or preempt the immediate experience of that person, but it isn't random either, because that, you know, there is this sense of recognition of universal processes. So it's like, how does this personal story that's emerging in this moment give us some insight into these patterns that actually every human at some level knows, and how can this conversation serve to kind of shine a light on those processes?
But in the emergence of the moment, I've been thinking about this a lot lately in my teaching, because early in a teaching career, I don't know if this is the same for everyone, but like you feel that there's something to do, like I have to convey this information, and it's my goal. And I fail if I just don't get this across. Like, I have to tell people something to do. Mm-hmm. And I think in the evolution as an educator and in the teaching career, you realize this openness that you're talking about in that moment, you show up. And of course you need structure. Like there is something to be accomplished today with intention, with the teacher type attitude, but there's nothing like to do. You're not like forcing people to know things. It's showing up, and you yourself are kind of the vessel where that doing can happen on. It's like you show up to the classroom and I'm going to present some things, and I'm not sure where it's headed. I know I have a problem to solve, and you all are interested in solving your own problems, and I have I do not know the answer to this. And I think that has become part of the beauty of the dance of my personal career. It's just like not knowing in front of a lot of people. And it's very uncomfortable, because you're like, you know, I don't know where this goes sometimes. Mm-hmm. And admitting that in real time and exploring together. And in that way, you're not trying to, it's hard to explain, but you're not trying to actually get people to do anything. you're trying to show yourself as a model for being confused and uncovering.
Beautiful. Right? I love the way you've articulated that. It's really beautifully expressed. Yeah, there's this sort of dynamic where, of course, you know, the teacher is coming with knowledge and experience and, you know, to some extent expertise, but actually in that moment, the only person who really knows about the experience that's been expressed is the participant themselves. And so the just as you're expressing is this, you know, the teacher's role is to just really help that unfolding, and to be alongside while the participant reveals to themselves their own wisdom, which they already is already inside of them in some way. And I think that's sort of the other piece you're pointing to is the sort of development, the very natural developmental trajectory for all of us as we engage in teaching. And it's not a linear thing, you know, we cycle around this in all sorts of ways. But in the, you know, in the earlier stages, there is the, you know, almost necessarily there is more of a kind of almost mechanistic doing sense that has to happen while we learn the ropes and engage with the curriculum and learn the, you know, some of the logistics and get the contextual knowledge that's necessary. And all of that is taking attentional resources, which in some ways makes it harder for us to be a kind, you know, in sort of embodied and present fully. But as we just get familiar and more at ease with the process, there is a way in which we can let go of a lot of that, and it becomes embedded within us on a sort of you know, on a vi almost a visceral level, and the intuitive capacities that we have become more available, and we can just flow with things. We can trust that our own experience and knowledge is within us, and we don't need to hold it in mind in the moment because it's available when it's needed. So there is much more available within us to be present to the process in a much more wholehearted way. And this is what you see with more experienced teachers. There is this greater fluidity and flow, and often a sense of them, you know, actually not following the rules as such, you know, it's kind of, it's much more emergent.
Right, guys. When we can embody that concept that we're trying to get across. I like your point. It's a, we're less thinking about what we're supposed to be doing, more showing the thing we're trying to convey. And so you bring up multiple points. Through the many years, this last decade, you've put out a lot of work. I've been following this work. And parts of the integrity of a program we might just want to cover because there's three. You kind of bookmark it into three: adherence, differentiation, and competence. So adherence, is that like the structural piece where you get the ingredients right? So we do need the ingredients, or else we don't really know what the program is, right? So this is the curriculum piece. Maybe we'll start there in the adherence section and getting a curriculum across. What do you think are major lessons learned just for this one? What are the hard parts of doing something like that? What is the best way to teach people how to do that? Or is that like the easiest one? Because you
I think
just.
that is the easiest one. I mean, that's genuinely our experience, and we did some research on this when we were developing the tool that we evolved in our center, which is now used really widely, the MBI TAC, the Mindfulness-Based Interventions Teaching Assessment Criteria. So when we did research using that tool, which looks at different aspects of the skill of the teacher, and one aspect of them is the curriculum, delivering the curriculum, as it were. And that actually was the area of skill that our trainees had the highest levels of competence in earliest on in their journey of learning to teach. So I think there is this sense in which the sort of the logistics of the curriculum are, you know, they are very learnable. Interestingly, I've done quite a bit of collaboration with my colleague, Dr. Rick Hecht, at UCSF. And one of the reasons he got interested in collaborating with me around these pieces is that he'd conducted a randomized trial where they'd looked just at adherence, as a measure of fidelity. And they discovered that the teachers who were most adherent actually were not getting the best results. And that gave him an indication that adherence as a measure of the integrity of a program, particularly of a mindfulness program, is potentially a bit flawed because adherence, one needs to take a broader perspective of adherence, which isn't just a mechanism. Yes, a body scan was delivered in session one. Yes, inquiry happened. It needs to go beyond. So what the hypothesis that they arrived at within their team was that the teachers who were less adherent were actually being more responsive.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, go ahead.
No, got you. Yeah.
Well, as you're talking, something's coming to mind about sometimes when I've sat in as a substitute teacher for a subject, and I just want to explore what happens there for a minute. Mm. So you walk into a room, there's no history, right? Mm. And you know what to get across, and this will maybe take us back to our earlier teaching years because you have a limited amount of time. The relationships have not been built at this point, and you could try everything, but everyone knows they understand the circumstances, temporary. There's no life to it, longevity, and you're trying to just stand in. And in that type of delivery, it makes me kind of fall back to that rote delivery of information. Okay. And in a way, I was just thinking of as a potential example, and I know substitute teachers, this is not their fault. It's just the challenge of standing in.
Right.
Maybe something along those lines that sometimes you just try to get the points across, and whatever that dynamic is, that room of people is not buying into this history. You're missing the connections.
Yeah.
And maybe it's not a perfect example. I'm just trying to tie together the challenges some teachers face, either early career or standing in, and why they may not be winning over that group dynamic. Does that make sense at all?
It makes a huge amount of sense. I think, you know, there's this, the more nuanced, subtler elements that in a way, it's almost like Parker Palmer has this beautiful phrase where he talks about the hidden curriculum. And so it's, you know, there's just a huge amount that's going on that isn't in a way the immediacy of what you can see being delivered. You know, it's the way of being, the essence qualities, the, you know, the sense that, you know, if you look back at teaching experiences that you've had, you probably don't remember what they taught you, but you'll remember how you felt. So it's that sense of actually what's being conveyed at a felt level, which is what's going to stay with those participants. Parker Palmer calls it the hidden curriculum. We sometimes call it the implicit curriculum. And there's this sense that in a mindfulness context, we're foregrounding that in our teacher training, because that's what the teachers themselves need to be aware of it and to foreground when they're teaching. Of course, they're delivering a curriculum, and that's what is sort of everything hangs on. So it's necessary. But it's by no stretch of the imagination the full story of what's happening in the teaching space.
And so the parts that we'll get back to now, the adherence piece, we talked about getting the ingredients right. Then there's this important, the differentiation piece, right? The degree to which the approach can be distinguished from other approaches. And this is especially important when in the science world, we're trying to make sure we're only giving people the independent variable or the program that we're intending to give. So based on all this experience that you've accumulated through the years, when do you see the problem with differentiation happening, and like, how do you reel people back in?
Yeah, well, I think it can happen a lot because of this piece that is so important, which is that people need to teach from their own experience. But one of the hazards of that is that, you know, some people, you know, you go off on a weekend workshop and you discover this new way, you know, new way in or a new style of practice, and you want to share it with everybody because it's had such a profound influence on you. And so you want to integrate it into your mindfulness-based stress reduction teaching, but it doesn't actually belong there. It's not part of the segueing that has been really carefully thought about in that particular curriculum. So this sort of dropping in of elements that people are drawing from other places, which don't really belong. You know, sometimes there is a really good rationale for adaptation. But that needs to be based on a really clear understanding of the intentionality of the program, the participants, the context, not on some sense that the teacher has over something that has really moved them or influenced them in some way. So it's like, where's this addition coming from? What's the rationale underneath it? And I think this risk of drift is quite significant. How do we find ways within research and practice to get clear, you know, what does belong and what doesn't belong? And this was part of what we were aiming to do with the Warp and Weft paper, which was in a way to sort of highlight the key ingredients that are absolutely essential if you're calling any program a mindfulness-based program. And then there are some variable ingredients, but those variable ingredients can be woven in, but they need this very clear rationale and understanding. And my colleague Eric Laux at Brown has just written a sister paper to the Warp and Weft, which is about that adaptation process and when and how one does it, and you know what might be the weft ingredients, the variable ingredients. So it's just the care and thought that needs to go around that is significant.
And my learning on those different papers that came out, because I've tried to wrap my head around these different issues that have come up, and one that seems to stand out as an example, and you've seen this more practically in the delivery, so you can educate me more on this. So if you're delivering like a mindfulness-based stress reduction program, there is no cognitive behavioral content as like, it should not be a psychotherapy, seeing thoughts and revising those thoughts, trying to change thinking patterns, recognizing thinking behavior link and altering that. So do you want to just use maybe that as the example? Like if you're delivering MBSR, what territory don't we head into in the way we're using our mind and attention from the teacher's perspective? Like what do you, the ways in which you're working with people, you're not kind of doing certain things with them.
Yeah.
What might that look like?
Yeah. So there's a raft of very beautiful strategies that are used in CBT therapy, which I think you're referring to here, which are very much designed to help people see and challenge various thinking patterns that are not helpful. And within a mindfulness context, within a mindfulness intervention such as MBSR, you know, for sure, we are looking at mind processes. We're looking at thoughts and their interactions with emotions and the interactions with sensory experience and the interactions of all of that with how we act and behave in the world. So all of that is definitely on the table for investigation. But it's really the how of the investigation. So, you know, we're not looking to replace anything. We're looking to hold it all in awareness and to recognize for ourselves from a wisdom perspective, you know, aspects of how we're engaging with our own process that are not serving. But it isn't a sense of coming in and modifying it. It's more a sense of, you know, where's the potential within this for me to keep evolving how I engage with my experience, but it's coming from the light of awareness and engagement with it from a practice perspective. So it's a really different methodology. It's almost, you know, coming in through the body door rather than through the thought door that we're exploring here. And as you say, I mean, psychoeducation, you know, there is psychoeducation in MBSR. We are sharing with our participants processes around stress and the physiology but we're doing all of that. So the psychoeducation is coming from a connected perspective. So it's not a sort of didactic delivery. It's engaging participants' whole body, whole mind, whole heart experience with an exploration of how do I know stress? And then of course linking that with some of the contemporary understanding of stress, but it's doing it through the whole being of that participant, through their sort of whole engagement, so that hopefully, you know, with the hope that actually this will still be with them when they you know, it's not just a sort of cognitive piece that they'll take in and then forget, because they're engaging through their body door, and so it's landing in a deeper and hopefully more long-term way.
You see, I think it's a cultural feature, maybe West and European evolution of thinking of the mind. And it seems almost intuitive for this cultural approach to want to fix elements of the mind. And I can imagine, and tell me if this is true or not, when teachers early on come in, they might, in a program, someone's coming up with a sensory experience. It's a lot to handle. There's big emotion being felt, and the person like tries to help. Does that happen? And again, why isn't that the approach?
And of course it does happen. And and this is why it's so important that we all have colleagues and supervisors and mentors to help us explore our process. So in the UK, it's a requirement that teachers engage with a supervisor. And actually, this is one of the big pieces that we encourage people to engage with their supervisors around, is, you know, the very wholesome wish for the participants in your space to be free of suffering. But then, you know, the natural engagement that then happens is to give them, you know, your ideas about how that might come about. And that's actually not the relevant piece here. So it's like, you know, that's the boundary, that's the tipping point. And so blood, yes, to the wholesome desire to engage from that place, but actually recognizing when that's tipping into fixing, because that interrupts this whole engagement with this other way of being with experience, which is actually going to be what's more potent for that person to take away, rather than some temporary fix, which isn't actually going to give them any sustained satisfaction, you know, from what they did, from the challenges they're experiencing. Yeah.
And this makes me think about the language, right? This is the medium of the exchange between the relational dynamic between teacher and student, and language and is hard enough on its own to get it right. The relational dynamic and mindfulness programs is so important, just because I believe what we just said, it's not projecting, it's not fixing, it's not doing all those things that we may have a tendency to want to do.
Yes.
The language that people as early teachers of mindfulness-based programs learn is there's an art to it. Why is language so important? And what have you learned about the use of language? Because this is like one of the competencies, or competence is the last of the third pillars that you mentioned in your work. And language is coming to mind for me. How do we use language in mindfulness-based programs? Why is it important?
Language is just hugely important, because it's how we construct meaning. So we have a lot of conversations about languaging with our trainees, within our trainer group. You know, there's a whole, and it's, of course, it crops up a lot because we train a lot internationally. So a lot of our trainees are then needing to make sense of this in their own language. And we use in English the ing word, you know, bringing your attention to your experience, coming to a sitting place, inviting away, you know. So all of, you know, this sort of process orientated invitational language is a very different instruction to sit down, bring the attention to your, you know, which is much more instructional. So finding ways where we can invite this sort of open invitational engagement is really important. And there's so much more around language. We could spend the rest of the podcast on this theme.
Because I mean, it's so important because it's the medium, right? Without it, we couldn't do any of this work. And what's coming to mind for me is, I remember a training we were doing once in a MBRP relapse prevention program. And, you know, we had a dynamic, and you probably did this in MBSR and others. You can tell me about this, where you have two teachers working together and they're doing guided meditations for each other because we are trying to get the language right in a way. We're trying to perhaps do other things, but trying to get the language right. And for anyone listening, I mean, it might sound silly, like just say, just give instructions. Try it yourself. It is like the hardest thing to do. And how do you know? Because of the feedback process, you may have thought you were right on the mark, did something well. And when you have this other teacher saying, well, you know, actually that kind of made me feel closed off. You kind of pushed me out of my body. I felt like I was being forced to do things. And you realize in that moment, wow, like I really don't know how to communicate language effectively, because you have so many units that are conscious right now on these students. And how do I know? And it could be a place of anxiety, right? So for those young teachers, what have you seen, and how do you help them find that language that seems to work more universally?
I mean, I think what you've just described is one way, is to guide and to get feedback on it. I mean, that's beautiful. And that's actually one of the core training methodologies we use, is actually just to be in peer groups, guiding each other and giving each other feedback. And there's now the whole new understanding around trauma sensitivity has really shifted our practice just in the last 5 years. We've always been reflecting on language, but there's been a big shift in our thinking, and I think in the whole field's thinking, around ways of languaging things and ways of framing things that are, you know, might inadvertently be excluding certain groups of people who've experienced trauma, or certain groups of people who are socially marginalized in some way. So it's like, how do we create places of as much safety as is possible, and as much of a sense of belonging as is possible, and as much a sense of agency as possible. So like, I'm not telling you to do this, but I'm offering an invitation here, and it, you know, engage to the extent that is appropriate for you, but to please be in charge of your own, the discernment that you need to have about how far you go with this and when you step back. So that sense of, you know, encouraging our participants to really calibrate their own levels of intensity and to know when to step back. I think that's really been informed by this latest thinking on trauma sensitivity. And that's in turn shifted. I mean, in some ways it's added more complexity to how we language things, because we're having to add more choice in there. But it's been a really important development, and it's an ongoing learning, I think, for all of us to create spaces that are inclusive to a diversity of people.
The art and language, right? I mean, I'm just thinking as you're talking now, how do we even make this happen? We are the art and language as a medium to convey something that seems impossible. Welcome to the experience of your own mind.
Yeah.
Like, what in the world does that even mean? And absolutely. People in our first classes are probably thinking, what in the world is happening?
Yeah.
Somehow with good teachers, you know, they can help that student come to know their own mind. Now, how does that happen? Wow.
Absolutely. And, you know, we engage with people before they say yes to coming to a mindfulness course, to give them as much information as possible about what to expect. But actually, the truth is, there's no way they can really know what this is about until they actually start engaging in the process themselves. And then, you know, this is where I think it's very different having a teacher to learning mindfulness on an app, you know, that there is this relational connection that I think is absolutely vital to enabling people to move into this with a level of depth that is going to enable them to take away something that is of lifelong significance. And I do think apps also have their place, but I don't think they would ever take people in a way that that engagement with a teacher can take people. And there's something about actually having that relational connection that really gives people a sense of doability, you know, confidence in staying with a process that will inevitably be difficult, because it, you know, by definition, this process is going to take you to the places you really don't want to go to. And But that's exactly where you need to be in order to discover something new.
Maybe we should define that for people who aren't as familiar. So when you say places you don't want to go to, it's an intimate connection of knowing yourself. And sometimes when people get to that point, might find things they don't like to see.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, you know, a classic example when we're, you know, teaching mindfulness-based cognitive therapy for people with depression. So when they're in remission from depression, the very last thing they want to do is to bring to mind the processes of mind that, you know, the difficult thoughts that tend to come with depression and the painful emotions that come with depression. But necessarily, actually, we will be visiting those places because it's the potential of a different way of being and of of moving things in different directions is actually rests on the relationship we have with those inner voices or those inner felt experiences. So in order to actually discover new ways of being, we have to evoke them and bring them to mind.
Yeah, I like your example. The denial in itself is where the power of the recurrence is, right?
The pushing away. Yeah. The not wanting to go there. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's part of that process.
Absolutely.
Very nicely said. I want to cover this tool that you created, the MBI TAC. So I read a lot about this. And there are six domains, and there's a lot to cover. So I don't want to cover everything, but just to bring an interest to this, it's well used, it's used internationally. And we talk, we've covered some of it. But the first one is something like coverage, you know, did you cover all the content from the sessions, the relational skills? We mentioned some of these. I like what you said here in the relational skills piece, because you talk about co-journeying, you know, it's this highly participatory process. And I think we got to it. Is there anything else you want to talk about this co-journeying? Because from a teacher's perspective, the reason I love that term is because when I show up to a class, I also want to learn. Like I am there because if I'm by myself, I can't learn as much.
Yeah.
And so if you have that in your heart, like this passion to be, I'm showing up because I also have something to gain.
Right.
Is it that and what else?
Absolutely. So one of the descriptors in the whole description around the relational domain is this sense of mutuality. So, you know, there is, you know, it's so important that the participants feel that the teacher is sitting alongside them. We don't sit in a circle for a random reason. We sit in the circle because it really embodies this sense that we're all here together in this human condition. And we're all, as you said at the beginning of this interview, we're all fumbling along in some way, discovering and, you know, finding out different dimensions and aspects of what it is to be human. And here we're going to fumble together. And of course, the teacher's bringing something particular, you know, and some experience in how to fumble. But you know, there is this mutuality in that process, which is vital. And the sense that, you know, we're asking a lot of these participants in their engagement. It's really hard work. It's intense in terms of the time commitment, but it's also intense in terms of the challenge that it will bring up and the ways it will press every button that you have. And so the teacher isn't decreeing that others will do this. They're also engaging in the same level of time commitment and willingness to actually inhabit their experience, including the difficult dimensions of experience. So yeah, this kind of mutual willingness is really important.
Are there times when, because we see this with students, like there are some students who philosophically won't take that stance with us. And it's really hard as a teacher to realize the point when you don't know if you can cross that bridge with a person. I don't know if this is common because I'm sure a lot of people have a disposition towards really wanting to help others. But I can also see maybe that could be problematic, whereas in the philosophy to really help doesn't co-journey. It's the fixing thing we talked about. Does this come up and what's a good way to handle it?
So it definitely does come up. And, you know, so one of the ways that we're using the MBI TAC is to, so we encourage our trainees and experienced teachers, all of us, in fact, are recording our classes at different times and getting feedback on these. And the MBI TAC is partly designed as a tool to enable structured reflective feedback on practice. And in our training programs, our trainees get that at, you know, at multiple intervals through their training journey. So they're, you know, they're likely to be getting feedback on that if that's a particular aspect of their process that's showing up. And they'll be being asked to write reflective journals on what's emerging. And so it's pretty intense demand in terms of them being seen in practice, being asked to reflect on this, bringing it to their supervisor, and reflecting also on, you know, the whole principle underpinning mindfulness. And so, you know, they're getting it from all angles. So it's in a way, it's a cauldron of learning and shaping how we engage. Many of our trainees come into teaching mindfulness from having engaged with other therapeutic modalities. And for them, for many, there's this process of unlearning. There's some, you know, some things that are very helpful in other modalities, but not necessarily helpful in this context. And often, you know, there's a huge appreciation around that, but habits die hard. So it's kind of, you know, just often for people a learning process to see themselves again and again tripping into old habits. And it's often, you know, for all of us, these habits come up, particularly at moments when there's stress, or, you know, we're not sure what to do. You know, we all have particular defaults that we'll go to at those moments. And for many who've had, I know, particular trainings, it would be to go into a fixing, telling, directive, instructional mode.
And you could feel that. Maybe it's with experience. There's a different feel. And I catch myself, luckily, catching myself more and more quickly. Right. Yeah, in those moments, you're like, wait, what is happening right now? This is not
lovely.
This is not what I came here to do. This is not kind of my approach anymore.
Yeah.
And often I will offer this up, you know, and I think it just takes confidence to know that you can sit with something and be uncomfortable, just be opening to the group. I don't know how to answer this right now. I really have no idea.
Beautiful.
I have no idea how to approach this. But you know what? Maybe I will, because there is part of you that is being honest. Like, maybe I will, actually. Let me think on it more. Let me research something a little bit more. Let me talk to other teachers. And that always something feels right about that, that tension in the chest or whatever it is when you're, because I think it is a return to that doing. It's like, okay, I'm just going to accomplish this. And by doing that, I'm going to prove I figured this out.
Exactly.
And it just feels so gross. As you, you know, you move into your career, it's like, it doesn't feel right. Why do I even want to do that? It's a disharmony to what we're doing.
Yeah. I love that sense of what you're saying. You can feel it, but you can only feel it if you're aware. And that's where the practice is so important. And this was my training. So when I was training originally in Bangor with Mark Williams, he would be recording my practice and we'd sit down together and he would press the pause button and say, tell me what was happening for you in that moment. Can you go back to actually the feel of it in your body? And we, you know, our ideal is to do this with our students as well. And, you know, to help them have that same level of reflective process using videos or using their memory of experiences when they're talking with supervisors. So a great supervisor would be inviting just that, you know, the trainee would bring to the supervisor, you know, an awkward moment in the teaching, and the supervisor would help them unpack it in terms of the, you know, the thoughts that were going on in that moment, the emotions, the visceral feel, actually, what did you do? So this unpacking of these moments in the teaching process is really revealing. Of those tipping points, as you say, from, you know, in one sense, you know, from a sort of being, more of a being mode into, as you say, more of a doing, driven doing mode.
Yeah, a question that's coming to mind, one that occurs is, what am I forcing to happen right now?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the the thinking that attaches to whatever that emotion is, like, what are you trying to force into the world at this moment? And once you ask that question, you're like, oh, maybe I shouldn't be forcing anything into the world in this moment, because we're not uncovering, we're not being curious, we're not exploring together. I somehow know something you need to know. And that's when it just turns gross for me personally.
Yes, absolutely. And I noticed for myself, I have a sort of tendency to sort of literally physically lean in a bit more. And so actually recognizing my body doing that and deliberately settling back and coming into a more receptive mode. So that I'm sort of, in a way, letting my body help me shift back into a more connected, responsive mode rather than a kind of leaning forward, reactive mode. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you said this well in your 2016 publication about the importance of everything we're talking about today, that if you train a mindfulness teacher in their 30s, they might teach over 4,000 people in their career. So you argue that, you know, quality of training, of supervision and support is important. So that tells you about the importance of the topic. These are a lot of people being influenced, and potentially a lot of people that are influenced negatively. Yeah. So is that still, we're at that 4,000 mark? You think it's even greater?
I mean, I don't, it could be greater, you know, it's, you know, we're involved in training colleagues to offer MBCT in the NHS, which is in the UK, is really, the uptake of that is really expanding. And many of those colleagues, teaching MBCT will become, you know, the main or the most significant component of their role. And yeah, they're going to touch a lot of people. And how that touching happens is of really, really matters. And you can feel the ripples that go out from there. Each of those participants is embedded in a family system. And, you know, the ripples from this work are significant.
Yeah. And your work has been to try to ensure that quality, bolster competence, and in the end, reduce suffering, because you would want people to get the program that's intended, that appears to have the most benefit. So looking forward, is there any new problem as part of this you're working on? You're excited about something new?
Well, the area that I think many of us are engaged in at the moment, and it's becoming more and more kind of a central component of my work, is the context of the time we're in. So when John developed MBSR in the 1970s, there was significant world trouble at that time too. But it is different, the nature and the level of the trouble that we're in as a society and as a planet is much greater now. And this, you know, I think that also the way in which, in order to support the uptake of mindfulness into the mainstream, the research and probably the practice has focused a lot on the benefit to the individual. And it feels really central for us, both from a research perspective, to be opening out much more to capturing the collective benefits of this engagement. But from a practice perspective, also getting more skillful about how the teaching can more profoundly rest into the deep truth that actually my well-being is totally contingent on your well-being and on the well-being of all living systems. And the recognition that the spaces that we've created have not been truly inclusive of the breadth of demographic of our society, and that, you know, the mindfulness field is very skewed in terms of who's teaching and who's training. So there's some big challenges, you know, for us all in terms of, you know, how do we, you know, engage with our own processes to you know, internally step up, and actually, it, you know, it's not just about bringing in greater diversity of teachers, it's about culture from within, of, you know, how we're orienting and how we're inadvertently not creating spaces that are inclusive, but also, you know, more broadly, how we, you know, what's the contribution that we particularly can make at this time of crisis in the world. You know, it absolutely It's becoming so clear that technologically the problems of climate change can be solved, but that the major barrier is at the level of the human, and it's us and our ways of thinking and our ways of being that are actually stopping the transformation that's needed. So it's this sort of, how can the cultivation of inequalities be part of the transformation that's needed to enable us to shift on a societal level? So those are the themes that I am really animated by at the moment, and genuinely feel excited to engage and contribute, as because it seems like the most vital thing I could be doing, we could be doing at this time.
Wonderful. And you are contributing to that. And I thank you for your work and helping us be competent in our delivery of these programs, doing them well. It's a final point for me. How do we do something
How
well
do we,
as teachers and with our best heart in mind? So that's it for today. Thank you, Dr. Crane. We can find our podcast recordings at goamra.org, goamra.org. Where you can support us and become a member. That's it for today. Bye now.